number?
Yes, it's my cell. Look, I'm not looking to put her name out there publicly. It would just help me to know it. I'm interviewing Orton today. It makes it hard to go at him on this if I don't even know the victim's name. I understand, and I will ask her. Thank you. Going back to my first question, you said you would ask how many lives he has ruined. You think there were more than just your client? Put it this way. The case I handled was not an aberration, and that's off the record. I can't talk about the case or him at all. Well, if we're off the record, what did you think about the DNA report? Detective Ruiz said he was pretty shocked by that. You talked to Ruiz, huh? Yeah, it was a big fucking shock. How'd Orton get around it? When you find out, let me know. Did you try to find out? Of course, but I got nowhere. Was tampering involved? Who knows? Can someone change their DNA? Gaspar started laughing. That's a good one. I didn't mean it as a joke. Well, put it this way. If Orton invented a way to change his DNA, he'd be the richest asshole in California, because a lot of people would pay big bucks for that. You could start with the Golden State Killer and work your way down from there. Last question, I said. Does the NDA you or your client signed cover the records of your investigation, or could I look at what you've got in your files? He laughed again. Nice try. What I thought. Mr. Gaspar, I would appreciate it anyway if you would give my name and number to your client. She can talk to me in confidence. I will promise her that. I will tell her, but I will also advise her that she risks breaking the agreement if she does. I understand. I disconnected and sat in my car thinking. So far, my trip down to Orange County had produced nothing that pushed the needle or made any connection between the four deaths that I was ostensibly investigating and William Orton or Orange Nano. My phone buzzed, and it was Emily. I just got off the 405. Where are you? I gave her directions to where I was parked, and she said she'd be there in 5 minutes. I got a text before she arrived. It was from the 714 area code, Orange County. Jessica Kelly. I assumed that the name had come from Gaspar, and he had used a burner phone that could not be traced back to him. This told me a number of things. First, that he was concerned enough about Orton to break the NDA, but to do it in a way that gave him protection. It also said he was the kind of lawyer who used burner phones, and that could be useful down the line. I texted a thank you and added that I would be in touch. No reply came. I added the number to my contact list, assigning it the name Deep Throat. I was a reporter because of Woodward and Bernstein, the Washington Post duo who took down a president with the help of a confidential source they had given that nickname. I saw Emily's car pull to the curb in front of me. It was a small Jaguar SUV, and it was nicer than my Jeep. I got out with my backpack and got into the passenger seat of her car. I checked my phone and saw we still had time to kill. So, I said, tell me about the feds. I talked to a guy I had worked with on other stories, Emily said. He's with Federal Trade Commission Enforcement, which used to have oversight of the DNA industry until it got too big, and the FTC turned it over to the FDA, which basically does nothing. Exactly. But my guy can still dip into the licensing records and the database. And? And basically, these DNA labs have to be licensed. But as you know, there's no oversight or enforcement after that. However, the FDA does have to accept complaints. And my guy told me there was a flag on Orton. Is that on the record? On the record, but not for attribution. Where did the flag come from? He could not get that, but my guess is that it was from UCI and what happened there. That seemed most likely to me. All right, I said. Anything else? One other thing, Emily said. Orange Nano's license has an amendment allowing it to share anonymized data with other licensed research facilities. So the data it gets from GT23 can pass through the lab and Orange Nano and go somewhere else. Is any approval required of such transactions? Not at this time. It's apparently going to be part of the rules and regs the FDA is taking its sweet time with. We need to find out who they give DNA to, I said. We can ask Orton when we see him, but I kind of doubt that will go anywhere. We'll see soon enough. What about Jason Hwang, disgruntled ex-employee of the mothership? Maybe he knows something and will share. Maybe. But he would be a transaction removed. He sent DNA to Orange Nano. He would have no control and probably no knowledge of where it went afterward. What about your FTC guy? I'll try him. But the FTC washed its hands of the DNA industry when the FDA took over. Whatever he can get will be at least 2 years old or more. Well, it's worth a shot. I'll call him later. What did you get from the cop on the UCI case? She asked. I talked to him in court, and then I called the lawyer who represented the UCI victim, Jane Doe. Actually, it's Jessica Kelly. Who gave you that? I think Gaspar, the lawyer. I explained the text I had gotten. Good stuff, Emily said. If she's still around, we can find her. She signed an NDA, so that may be a dead end. But having the name will help us with Orton, if the case comes up. Oh, I think it's going to come up. Are we ready? We are. Chapter 21. Orange Nano was in a clean industrial park off MacArthur and not far from UCI. It was a single-level precast concrete building with no windows and no sign out front identifying it. The front door led to a small reception area where we found Edna Fortunato, the woman I had been told by Rexford PR would get us to William Orton. She escorted us into an office where two men sat waiting, one directly behind a large desk and the other to his left side. The office was basic, a desk cluttered with files and paperwork, diplomas framed on one wall, shelves of medical research books on another, and finally, a 6-foot-tall sculpture in a corner that was an abstract double helix made of polished brass. The man behind the desk was obviously Orton. He was about 50, with a tall and slim build. He stood up and easily reached across the wide desk to shake our hands. Though ostensibly looking for the cure to baldness, he had a full head of brown hair slicked back and held in place with heavy product. His bushy, unkempt eyebrows gave him the inquisitive look of a researcher. He wore the requisite white lab coat, his name stitched above the breast pocket, and pale green scrubs. The other man was the mystery. Dressed in a crisp suit, he remained seated. Orton quickly solved the mystery. "I am Dr. Orton," he said, "and this is my attorney, Giles Barnett." "Are we interrupting something you two need to finish?" I asked. "No, I asked Giles to join us," Orton said. "Why is that?" I asked. "This is just a general interview." There was a nervousness about Orton that I had seen before in people unaccustomed to dealing directly with the media, and he had the added burden of worrying about his secret discharge from UCI. It seemed that he had brought his lawyer to make sure the interview didn't stray into an area Emily and I surely intended to take it. "I need to tell you at the outset that I don't want this intrusion," Orton said. "I rely on Rexford Corporation to sponsor my work, and so I cooperate with their demands. This is one of them. But as I say, I don't like it, and I am more comfortable with my attorney present." I looked over at Emily. It was clear our planning for the interview had been for naught. The scheme to slowly lead Orton down a path toward a discussion of his past troubles would now clearly be stopped by Giles Barnett. The attorney had a tight collar and the thick body of an offensive lineman. In my glance at Emily, I tried to get a read on whether she thought we should abandon ship or press on. She spoke before I could make a determination. "Could we start in the lab?" she said to Orton. "We wanted some photos of you in your element. We could get that out of the way and then do the interview." She was proceeding with the plan. Get photos first, because the interview was going to lead to a confrontation. It's hard to get photos after you've been ordered to leave the premises.
You can't go into the lab, Orton said. There are contamination concerns and a strict protocol. There are, however, viewing windows in the hallway. You can take your photos from there.
That'll work, Emily said.
Which lab? Orton said.
You tell us, I said. What labs are there?
We have an extraction lab, he said. We have a PCR lab, and we have an analysis lab.
PCR? I asked.
Polymerase chain reaction, Orton said. It is where samples are amplified. We can make millions of copies of a single DNA molecule in a matter of hours.
I like that, Emily said. Maybe some shots with you involved in that process.
Very well, Orton said. He stood up and signaled us through the door into a hallway that led to the far reaches of the building.
Emily hung back so that Orton was several feet ahead of us, his lab coat flowing behind him like a cape. She took photos as we walked. I walked next to Barnett and asked him for a card. He reached behind the pocket square in the breast pocket of his suit coat and handed me an embossed business card. I glanced at it before putting it in my pocket.
I know what you're going to ask, Barnett said. Why does he need a criminal defense attorney?
The only answer is that it's only one of my specialties. I handle all Dr. Orton's legal work. That's why I'm here.
Got it, I said.
We turned down a 40-foot hallway with several large windows running along both sides. Orton stopped at the first set of windows.
Over here to my left is PCR, he said. To the right is the SDR analysis lab.
SDR? I asked.
Short tandem repeat analysis is the evaluation of specific loci, he said. This is where we hunt, where we look for the commonalities in identity, behavior, hereditary attributes.
Like balding, I asked.
That is certainly one of them, Orton said, and one of our main points of study.
He pointed through the window at a device that looked like a countertop dishwasher, with a rack containing dozens of test tubes. Emily snapped another photo.
Where does the DNA for your studies come from? I asked.
We buy it, of course, Orton said.
From who? I asked. You must need a lot. Our primary source is a company called GT23. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Nodding, I pulled a notebook out of my back pocket and wrote down his direct quote. While I was doing so, Emily continued her role as photographer.
Dr. Orton, I know we can't go into the lab, she said, but could you go in and sort of interact with what you see in there so I can take a few shots?
Orton looked to Barnett for approval, and the attorney nodded.
I can do that, Orton said.
And I don't see anybody in the labs, Emily added.
Don't you have staff that helps with your research?
Of course I do, Orton said, an irritated tone in his voice. They preferred not to be photographed, so they have the hour off.
40 minutes now, Barnett added helpfully.
Orton used a key to unlock the STR lab door.
He stepped into a man trap where an exhaust fan roared to life and then died. He used the key to open the next door and enter the lab. Emily walked up to the glass and tracked Orton through the lens of her camera. Barnett took the moment to move next to me.
What are you doing here? He asked.
Excuse me? I responded.
I want to know what is behind this charade.
I'm doing a story. It's about DNA and how it gets used and protected and who's out there on the frontier of the science.
That's bullshit. What are you really here for?
Look, I didn't come here to talk to you. If Dr. Orton wants to accuse me of something, let him do it.
Call him out here and we'll all talk about it.
Not until I know.
Before he could finish, he was interrupted by the roar of the fan in the man trap. We both turned to see Orton stepping out. Concern was written on his face, as he had either heard the confrontation or seen the pointed discussion through the lab's window.
Is there a problem? He asked.
Yes, I said before Barnett could respond. Your lawyer doesn't want me to interview you.
Not until I know what the interview is really about, Barnett said.
All at once, I knew the plan for a subtle lead-up was out the window. It was now or never.
I want to know about Jessica Kelly, I said. I want to know how you fixed the DNA.
Orton stared hard at me.
Who gave you that name? Barnett demanded.
A source I won't give up, I said.
I want you both out of here, Orton said. Right now!
Emily turned the camera on Orton and me and started firing off shots.
No pictures! Barnett yelled. Put that away right now!
His voice was so tight with anger that I thought he might lunge at Emily. I slid into the space between them and tried to salvage an unrecoverable situation. Over Barnett's shoulder, I saw Orton pointing toward the door we had come through from the office.
Get out of here!
He said, his voice rising with each word.
Get out!
I knew my questions were not going to be answered by Orton or his lawyer, but I wanted them on the record.
How'd you do it? I asked. Whose DNA was it?
Orton didn't answer. He kept his hand raised and pointing toward the door. Barnett started pushing me that way.
What's really going on here? I yelled. Tell me about Dirty Four, Dr. Orton!
Barnett shoved me harder then, and I hit the door with my back. But I saw that the impact of my words hit Orton harder. Dirty Four had registered with him. And for a moment, I saw the facade of anger slip. Behind it was trepidation, dread, fear. There was something there. Barnett shoved me into the hallway, and I had to turn to keep my balance.
Jack!
Emily cried.
Don't fucking touch me, Barnett, I said.
Then get the hell out of here,
the lawyer said. I felt Emily's hand on my arm as she walked by me.
Jack, come on, she said. We have to go.
You heard her, Barnett said. Time to go!
I followed Emily down the hall in the direction we had come from. The lawyer followed to make sure we kept going.
And I can tell you something right now, he said. If you print one word about Dr. Orton or one photograph, we will sue you and your website into bankruptcy. You understand that? We will own you!
20 seconds later, we were getting into Emily's car and slamming the doors. Barnett stood in the main entrance of the building and watched. I saw him looking down at the front license plate of Emily's car. Once we were in, he turned and disappeared inside.
Jesus Christ, Jack!
Emily yelled. Her hands were shaking as she pushed the button to start the engine.
I know, I said. I blew it. That's not what I'm talking about, she said. You didn't blow anything, because they fucking knew why we were coming. We were never going to get anything. They cleared everybody out of there, then started the phony dog and pony show. They were trying to extract information, not give it.
Well, we got something. Did you see his face when I said Dirty Four?
No, I was too busy trying to not get thrown into a wall.
Well, it hit him. I think it scared him that we know about it.
But what do we actually know?
I shook my head. It was a good question. I had another.
How'd they know what we were there for?
I had it set up through corporate PR.
Somebody we talked to.
Emily pulled out of the industrial park and headed back toward my Jeep.
No, I said. No way. The two guys I talked to today, the detective and the lawyer, they hate Orton's guts, and one of them gave me the name. You don't do that, and then turn around and warn Orton about why we're coming.
Well, they knew, Emily insisted.
What about your FTC guy?
I don't know. I don't see it. I didn't say anything about us coming down here.
Maybe he just tipped them off, said a reporter was sniffing around.
Then Orton gets word from corporate in Indianapolis to let me in. He calls his lawyer guard dog and is waiting for us.
If it was him, I'll find out. Then I'll burn his ass at the stake.
tension from the confrontation turned to relief now that we were in the car and away from Orange Nano. I involuntarily started to laugh.
That was crazy, I said. I thought for a moment the lawyer was going to go after you.
Emily started shaking her head and smiling, casting off tension herself.
I thought he was too, she said. But that was nice of you, Jack, to step in there between us.
It would have been pretty bad if something I said got you attacked, I said. A City of Irvine patrol car went streaking past us, its lights flashing, but no siren engaged.
You think that's for us? Emily asked.
Who knows? I said. Maybe. Chapter 22. Myron Levin frowned and told us that he needed to pull us off the story.
What? I said. Why?
We were sitting in the conference room, Emily, Myron, and me, after Emily's and my long separate rides back to L.A. We had just spent 30 minutes reviewing the events in Orange County.
Because it actually isn't a story, Myron said, and I can't afford to have you chasing after something for this long with no results.
We'll get results, I promised.
Not with what happened today, Myron said. Orton and his lawyer were ready for you, and they shut that whole avenue down. Where do you go from there?
We keep pushing, I said. The four deaths are connected. I know they are. You should have seen Orton's face when I said dirty four. There is something there. We just need a little more time to pull it all together.
Look, Myron said. I know there's smoke, and where there is smoke, there's fire. But right now, we can't see through the smoke, and we're hitting dead ends. I let you two run with this, but I need you back on your beats producing stories. I was never convinced this was a fair warning story in the first place.
Of course it is, I insisted. That guy down there has something to do with these deaths. I know it. I feel it. And we are obligated to
our readers and our mission, consumer watchdog reporting, Myron said. You can always take your suspicions and what you've found so far to the police, and that would take care of any other obligation you think you have.
They won't believe me, I said.
They think I did it. Not once your DNA comes back, Myron said. Talk to them then. Meantime, go back to your stations, refresh your story lists, and let's meet individually in the morning to sequence.
Damn it, I said.
What about if Emily goes back to her beat and I stay on Orton? Then you don't have half the staff on this.
Way to throw me under the bus, asshole, Emily said. I spread my hands.
It's my story, I said. What's the alternative? You stay on it and I go back to the beat? That's not happening. And neither is your scenario, Myron said. You're both back on the beats. Story lists in the morning. I have to go make calls.
Myron stood up and exited the conference room, leaving Emily and me staring at each other across the table.
That was really uncool, she said.
I know, I said. I think we were getting close.
No, I'm talking about you throwing me under. I'm the one keeping the story going, and you were the one who fucked it up with that lawyer.
Look, I admit I messed up with the lawyer and Orton, but you said yourself it wasn't going to go anywhere. And it was probably your FTC contact who tipped him off.
But this thing about you being the one keeping the story going, that's bullshit. We both had moves in play and were pushing it forward.
Whatever. I guess it doesn't matter now. She got up and left the room.
Shit, I said.
I contemplated things for a few moments, then pulled up my phone and composed a text to the contact I had labeled Deep Throat. I'm not sure who you are, but if you have anything else that can help me, now is the time. I just got pulled from the story for lack of progress. Orton was a bust. He was waiting and ready. In fact, there is no story. I need your help. I know some bad shit is going down out there, and Orton is the key. Please respond. I read it twice and wondered if it sounded like I was whining. Finally, I cut the last two words and sent it. I then got up and went back to my cubicle, passing Emily's on the way. I felt bad about what I'd said and the way things ended with her in the conference room. At my desk, I opened my laptop and went into a few folders labeled with stories I had been working on before Mattson and Sakai first showed up at my apartment. Top of the list was the King of Con Artists story, which had already been written and turned in, but not yet posted because there had been no time for me to sit down with Myron and go over his edit. That would be the first priority. After that, I looked at my futures list, but nothing excited me after being on the recent adrenaline-charged story chase. I next looked at my follow-up file. It contained stories that had already been posted, but that I knew I should circle back on to see if anything had changed. Whether the companies or government agencies had fixed the problems my stories had put the spotlight on. Though any reporter at Fair Warning could pursue a story of their own interest in any industry, I had informally been given the auto industry beat. For it, I had posted several pieces about sudden acceleration issues, faulty electronic control chips, dangerous gas tanks, and substandard parts, from outsourced integral assemblies to unregulated foreign manufacturers. The U.S. was an auto-based society, and these stories hit hard and drew attention. They ran in several newspapers, and I'd put on a jacket and tie to appear on the Today Show, as well as CNN, Fox, and several local news channels, including L.A., Detroit, and Boston, with Fair Warning getting credit all the way. It was a general rule that if you wrote a negative story about a Japanese car manufacturer, you would get on TV in Detroit. I knew that I could now piggyback on any one of these stories and probably get a solid nothing-has-changed piece. That might please Myron and help ease me away from the DNA story. I had a physical file in a desk drawer with all the documentation and contact information I had accumulated while originally reporting the auto industry stories. I now pulled it and slid it into my backpack so I could refresh my thoughts while taking my morning coffee. But I was done for the day. I couldn't simply transition from the unfinished story of Christina Portrero and William Orton to something wholly different and uninspiring. I needed time, and now I was going to take it. But I was still bothered by how things had just gone with Emily. I zipped up the backpack and got up and moved down the aisle to her cubicle. "Hey," I said. "Hey, what?" she replied curtly. "I made the wrong move in there. I shouldn't have thrown you under the bus, okay? If anything happens, we're both on it together. I just sent a text to my deep throat source and told him the story is on fumes and he needs to come through. We'll see. I probably sounded like a whiny asshole. Probably." But she looked up and smiled at me after saying it. I smiled back. "Well, thanks for being so agreeable about my deficiencies. Anytime. So," she turned her screen so I could see it. "Look what I just got." On her screen was what looked like a document with a Federal Trade Commission seal on it. "What is it?" I asked. "Well, I sent my FTC guy an email directly asking if he tipped off Orton," she said. "I exaggerated and said that if he did, he almost got me killed." "And?" "And he denied it. He even called me to deny it. And then he sent me this as some kind of gesture of good faith. It's the last list Orange Nano turned over to the FTC of labs it redistributed DNA to. It's almost 3 years old, but these might be worth checking out. I mean, if we were still on the story." Because it was a photo of a document, the writing was small and difficult to read from my angle. "Well, anything jump out right away?" I asked. "Not really," Emily said. "There's only 5 companies and all were registered with the FTC back then. I need to pull their profiles to get names, locations, things like that."
"And you're going to do that when?"
"Soon." She glanced over the top of her cubicle in the direction of Myron's pod. We could only see the top of his head, but the arch of his headphone crossed over his hair. He was on the phone. and the coast was clear. Emily corrected herself.
"Now," she said.
"Can I help?" I asked. I was about to leave, but I can stay.
"No, that will be too obvious. You go. I'll do this from home. I'll call if anything pops."
I hesitated before walking away. I didn't like the ball being in her court. Emily read me.
"I promise to call you, okay?" she said.
"And you call me if Deep Throat comes through."
"That's a deal," I said.
Chapter 23. I got to Mistral early and grabbed the same stool where I had sat the evening before. I put my backpack on the stool next to me to save it for Rachel, and after an exchange of bonsoirs with Elle, I ordered a Stella, deciding to go with a lower octane this night. I put my phone on the bar and saw that I had just gotten a pair of texts from Deep Throat. I opened them up and found two attachments. One was marked DNA and the other transcript. I opened the first and saw that my secret source had sent photos of the pages of a document. I quickly determined that it was the 4-year-old DNA analysis report from the Orange County Sheriff's Department forensics lab that found no match between William Orton's DNA sample and the DNA collected from Jessica Kelly. I scanned the report and realized that I would need a geneticist to translate what the bar chart, percentages, and abbreviations all meant. But the summary was clear. The saliva sample swab from the victim's nipples after her assault did not belong to William Orton. The attachment that came in the second text was a transcript of a very short interview with Orton conducted by Detective Digoberto Ruiz. It was 5 pages long, and once again the attachment was composed of photos of the hard copy pages. I forwarded both attachments to myself on email, then pulled out my laptop so I could download them and see them on a bigger screen. Mistral didn't offer its customers Wi-Fi service, so I had to use my cell as a hotspot connection. While I waited for everything to boot up and connect, I thought about the sender of the texts. I had asked Ruiz for the DNA report, not the attorney Hervé Gaspar. I was shifting my suspicions about Deep Throat, and now was thinking it was the police detective. Of course, Gaspar could have acquired the DNA report and interview transcript in the course of preparing a lawsuit against Orton, but the fact that the attachments were photographs of documents led me in the direction of Ruiz. Sending photographs instead of scans or real documents gave him an extra measure of protection against being identified as my source, should there ever be an internal investigation. Office scanners and copiers kept digital memories. My conclusion was further muddled when I was finally able to open the interview transcript on my laptop. I noticed that the document had several short redactions and was able to determine from context that the victim's name had been removed. This was puzzling, since Deep Throat had already provided me with the victim's name. Had he forgotten? Putting the question aside, I proceeded to read the entire interview. It was essentially 5 pages of denial from Orton. He did not assault the victim, he did not know the victim outside the one class he had with her, and he had not been with the victim. When Ruiz started walking him through the night in question in detail, Orton shut it down and asked for a lawyer. The transcript ended there. I closed my computer and put it away. I thought about the transcript. Aside from the redactions, there were also sections of Orton's answers highlighted in yellow. Wanting to keep the digital conversation with Deep Throat going, I used this as a reason to text him again and ask him what the highlights meant. His response came quickly, but indicated that Deep Throat was not as interested in conversation as I was. Checkable facts. That was all he said, but it was enough to further convince me that my source was Detective Ruiz. Checkable facts was a detective's term. An interview with a suspect in a crime is choreographed to draw answers that can be confirmed or disputed through witnesses, video, digital trails, cell phone triangulations, GPS navigation systems, and other means. This interview was no different, and someone, presumably Ruiz,
had highlighted the things Orton had said that could be proved or disproved. Of course, I had not gotten the follow-up reports on these checkable facts, so the interview transcript only served to intrigue me. I wanted more. Had Ruiz proved or disproved Orton's claim to have been somewhere else entirely on the night Jessica Kelly was assaulted? Had he proved or disproved his claim that he was the victim of a smear campaign at UCI, organized by another professor who was vindictive because of a dispute over tenure? I was about to compose another text to Deep Throat, saying I needed more information, when Rachel slipped onto the stool next to me, not the one I'd been saving with my backpack. "What's that?" she asked by way of a greeting. "I've been getting texts from somebody I think is the cop on the Orton case," I said. "I talked to him today, and he wouldn't tell me anything, but then I started getting these tips. This is a transcript of a short interview he had with Orton before he lawyered up. He denied everything, but put a few things on record that they could check. I was about to text and ask if he did." "A transcript? That sounds like a lawyer." "Well, it could be. I talked to the victim's lawyer also. He said he and his client couldn't talk because of an NDA, but I think it's the cop. He also sent the DNA analysis report that cleared Orton. I don't know if anybody would have had that but Ruiz." "The prosecutor who dropped the case probably had it, and he or she could have given it to the victim's lawyer." "True. Maybe I should just ask Deep Throat point blank who he is."
"Deep Throat. Cute."
I looked away from my phone to Rachel. "By the way, hello," I said.
"Hello,"
she replied. Starting the meeting with a discussion about my source had eclipsed the fact that we had spent the night together, and would again this night if intentions didn't change. I leaned over and kissed her on the cheek. She accepted the kiss and gave no indication of any tremor in the force. "So, were you up here again, or did you have to trek over the mountain?" I asked.
"I was here, just closing the deal from yesterday. I timed it to meet you."
"Congratulations. Or not?"
"I know I was whining yesterday. I was getting drunk. And it wasn't the only thing I said that was wrong."
There was a tremor.
"Really?"
I said. "Like what else?" Rachel was saved from answering immediately by the approach of Elle, the faux French bartender.
"Bonsoir," she said. "Would you like a drink?"
"Kettle One Martini straight up," she said.
"S'il vous plaît?"
"Bien sûr, coming up."
Elle moved down the bar to make the cocktail.
"That accent is terrible," Rachel said.
"You said that yesterday," I said. "Going with the hair of the dog, huh?"
"Why not? I signed a new client today. I can celebrate."
"So, what else did you say wrong yesterday?"
"Oh, nothing. Never mind."
"No, I want to know."
"I didn't mean to say that. Don't read anything into it."
The night before, this woman had whispered four words to me in the dark of the bedroom that rocked my world. "I still love you." And I had returned them without hesitation. Now, I had to wonder if she was trying to walk them back. Elle approached and put Rachel's drink down on a napkin. The martini glass was filled to the brim, and she had placed it too far from Rachel on the bar top for her to lean in and sip the level down before trying to lift it. Anything but a rock-steady hand would spill it when it moved. I knew then that Elle had heard what Rachel had said about her accent, and this was bartender payback. Elle retreated, throwing a wink at me that Rachel didn't see. A man took a stool in the middle of the bar, and Elle approached him with her bad accent. My cell screen lit as a call came in. I saw it was Emily Atwater. "I'd better take this," I said.
"Sure,"
Rachel said.
"Your girlfriend?"
"My colleague."
"Take it."
In one steady motion, Rachel lifted her glass, brought it across the bar top to her lips, and sipped. I never saw a drop spill. "I'm going outside so I can hear."
"I'll be here."
I grabbed the phone off the bar and connected. "Emily, hold on." I took a notebook out of my backpack, then walked through the bar and out the front door, where the music wouldn't intrude on the call. "Okay," I said. "You get something?"
"Maybe,"
she said. "Tell me."
"So, first,
You remember that what the FTC has is all over 2 years old, from before the FDA takeover.
Right.
So, prior to the switch to the FDA, there is a record of Orange Nano selling DNA code and biological samples to 5 other labs. 3 look like one-time transactions, and the other 2 were repeat customers. So I think we can assume that business continues.
Okay. Who are the 2 repeat customers?
First, I think we should keep clear lines. Orange Nano conducted these transactions, not Orton in particular. Yes, it's his lab, but he has employees, and they made these transactions. His name is not on a single document I looked at.
Okay. So did you see anything suspicious?
Suspicious? Not really. More like curious. The 2 repeat customers are nearby. Los Angeles and Ventura. The others were a little farther flung.
Which ones are you curious about?
The LA lab.
I heard papers rustling.
There were 3 things that popped for me on this one, Emily said. First of all, I Google mapped it, and it's not a commercial address. It's a residence. In Glendale, actually. I think the guy has a lab in his garage or something.
Okay, that's a little weird, I said. What else?
The business is registered with the FTC as Dodger DNA Services, and I think the owner is a DNA tech with the LAPD's forensics lab. I Googled him and his name came up in an LA Times story from last year about a murder trial where he testified about matching DNA taken from a gun to the defendant.
So what's his side business?
Well, the mission statement with the FTC says...
More paper rustling. I waited.
Here it is, Emily said. Testing applications of DNA in criminal forensics.
That's it.
Okay.
That's not that suspicious, I said.
It's his life work. He's probably trying to invent an instrument or something that will make his job easier and make him $1 million.
Maybe, until you get to my 3rd point of curiosity.
Which is?
He only bought female DNA from Orange Nano.
Okay, yeah. What's this guy's name?
Marshall Hammond.
Let me write that down.
I spelled the name out loud as I wrote it down, the phone held in the crook of my neck. Emily confirmed.
We need to background him, I said.
I tried, but nothing came up, Emily said. I was thinking you might try some of your old LAPD sources, see if you can get a take on him.
Yeah, not a problem. I'll make some calls. Are you still at the office?
No, I went home. I didn't want Myron to see this stuff on my desk.
Right. You get anything from Deep Throat?
Yes. He texted me the transcript of the interview with Orton and the DNA report that cleared him. I think Deep Throat is Detective Ruiz.
I'd like to read that interview.
I'll send it when we get off.
Where are you?
Meeting a friend for a drink.
Okay. See you tomorrow.
Let's take one more run at Myron with all of this stuff. See if we can get a couple more days.
I'm there.
Okay. See you then.
I went back into the bar and saw that Rachel had finished her drink. I slipped back onto the stool.
Ready for another? I asked.
No. I'm going to keep my wits about me tonight. Finish yours, and let's go to your place.
Yeah? What about dinner?
We can order in.
The Shrike. Chapter 24. He waited until it was dark. He loved the silence of the Tesla. The car was like him. It moved swiftly and stealthily. Nobody heard him coming. He pulled to the curb a block from the house on Capistrano and got out, silently closing the door behind him. He pulled the hood of the black nylon runner's shell up over his head. He already wore a clear plastic mask that distorted his facial features to better guard against identification should there be a camera in the neighborhood that picked him up. Everybody had motion-activated cameras around their homes these days. It made his work difficult. He carefully moved down the street, staying tucked into the shadows and out of the circles of illumination created by the streetlights. He had a small black duffel bag he kept tight against his body and under his arm. He finally reached the side yard of the Target house and slipped into its backyard through an unlocked gate. The house was dark, but the oval-shaped pool was lighted, most likely on a timer, and cast a shimmering glow into the house through a row of sliding glass doors. There were no curtains. He checked each of the sliders and found them locked. He then used a small pry bar from the duffel on the bottom of the center door to raise it up and out of its track. He carefully lifted it out and onto the concrete patio surface. This created a slight popping sound. He remained still, squatting next to the door and waiting to see if the disturbance had triggered an alarm or alerted anyone. No lights came on. No one checked the living room. He got up and slid the door open along the rough concrete surface, then entered the house. No one was home. A room-by-room search of the house determined that there were three bedrooms where no one was sleeping. Thinking it was possible that he had indeed awakened someone by popping the slider and that they were hiding somewhere, sent him through the house in a more thorough search that again produced no occupants, hiding or otherwise. But the second search led him to the garage, which he found had been converted into a laboratory. He realized that what he had found here was the lab support for Dirty Four. He set to work examining the equipment and the notebooks left on a work table, as well as data marked on hanging whiteboards and a calendar. There was also a desktop computer. When he pressed the space bar, he learned that it was thumbprint protected. He reached into his duffel for the roll of clear duct tape he kept among his tools and bindings. Leaving the garage, he walked through a TV room and found a powder room, the closest bathroom to the lab. He flicked on the light and peeled 2 3-inch segments of tape off the roll. He put one down on the sink counter with the sticky side up, then carefully and lightly applied the second to the top of the toilet's plastic flush handle. Raising the tape, he looked at it from an oblique angle. He had lifted a print. He could tell it was big enough to be a thumb. He put the tape down on top of the other segment, locking the print between the plastic. He then returned to the lab and sat at the computer. He took off a rubber glove and wrapped the plastic containing the captured print against his own thumb. He pressed it down on the desktop's reader square, and the computer's screen activated. He was in. He put his glove on and began moving through the files on the desktop. He had no idea where the homeowner was, but there was plenty on the computer for him to look through and attempt to understand. His study went on for hours and only ended after dawn, when he heard a car pull into the driveway on the other side of the garage door. He was alerted but did not bother to hide. He quickly prepared for the homeowner, then turned off the lights in the lab and waited. Soon, he heard footsteps in the house, and then the rattle of a set of keys being dropped on a table or counter. He noted this sound, thinking that he might need those keys and the car that was parked outside. He hated to part with the Tesla, but he might not be able to risk returning to it through the neighborhood in daylight. He had not planned to be in the house past dawn, and now the quick escape might be the best escape. The overhead lights in the lab came on, and a man took 5 steps into the room before stopping short when he noticed the intruder sitting at the lab table. "Who the fuck are you?" he said. "What do you want?" The seated man pointed at him. "You're the one who calls himself the Hammer, aren't you?" he asked. "Listen to me," Hammond said. "I work for the LAPD, and I don't know how you got in here, but you need to get the fuck out right now." Hammond pulled a cell phone from his pocket. "I'm calling the police," he said. "You do, and they will know all about your little side business of selling female data on the dark web," the intruder said. "Particular female data. You don't want that, do you?" Hammond put his phone back into his pocket. "Who are you?" he asked again. "You sent me an email," the intruder said. "An archaic method of communication. It was fair warning about a reporter from, fair warning, Jack McAvoy." Hammond's face had started to turn pale as he understood his situation. "You're the Shrike," he said. "Yes, and we need to talk," the intruder said. "I want you to sit in that chair there." He pointed to a chair he had prepared for Hammond. It was a wooden chair he had taken from one end of a table in the kitchen. He chose it because it had armrests to which he had attached zip ties, each with a very wide loop. Hammond didn't move. "Please," the intruder said, "I won't ask you again." Hammond tentatively went to the chair and sat down. "Put your hands through the plastic loops and then pull the tabs tight around your wrists," the intruder said. "I'm not going to do that," Hammond said. "You want to talk? We can talk. I'm on your side here. We sent you that email to alert you, as a warning. But I'm not going to tie myself up in my own house." The Shrike smiled at Hammond's resistance and spoke in a tone that suggested that Hammond was being a bit of a nuisance. "You're going to do it, or I'm going to go over there and snap your neck like a twig," he said. Hammond looked at him, blinked once, and then started putting his left hand through the loop on the armchair. "Now pull the tab tight." Hammond pulled the loop closed around his wrist, not even having to be told to make it tighter. "Now the other." Hammond put his right hand through the loop. "How do I tighten this one? I can't reach it." "Bend down and use your teeth." Hammond did as he was told, and then looked up at his captor. He waved his hands to show he was securely locked to the arms of the chair. "Okay, now what? Do you think I would bind you if I meant to harm you?" "I don't know what you would do." "Think about it. If I wanted to hurt you, it would have already been done, but now we can comfortably talk." "I'm not comfortable at all." "Well, I am, and so now we can talk." "Talk about what?" "The email you sent about this reporter. How did you know to send it to me?" "See, that's the thing. This is why you don't have to worry about me. I don't know who you are. We just have the email you used when you joined the site. That's it. No way of knowing who you are. So this," he shook his arms against the plastic bindings, "is completely unnecessary. Really, I mean it." The Shrike stared at him for a long moment, then got up and went to a printer that was on a table in the corner. He pulled a stack of documents out of the printer tray. He had been printing things through the night that had caught his interest on the lab's computer. He returned to his seat and held the stack on his lap. "You missed the point," he said without looking up from the documents. "How did you arrive at the decision to send me an email?" "Well," Hammond said, "you were the only one who downloaded the ones who died."
"At Dirty Four?"
"Yes, at the site."
"That is a problem. Your site promises full anonymity, but now you are saying you identified me through my interactions on the site. That is disappointing."
"No, wait, we did not identify you. That's what I'm saying. Right now, I could not tell you your name to save my life. We looked for anybody who had downloaded details about those whores who got killed. There was only one client. You. We sent the email in good faith. To warn you, because you have a reporter on your trail. That's it."
The Shrike nodded, as if accepting the explanation. He had noticed that Hammond was becoming more animated as his fear grew, and that was a problem because his wrists would chafe against the plastic bindings, and that would leave marks. "I'm curious about something," he said conversationally.
"What?"
Hammond asked. "Your operation is magnificent. How are you able to take the DRD4 samples and link them back to each woman's ID? I understand just about everything else but that, and that's the beauty of this whole thing." Hammond nodded in agreement.
"Well, that's proprietary, but I'll tell you. We totally own GT23's database, only they don't know it. We got inside. Complete access."
"How?"
"We actually encrypted a DNA sample with the Trojan horse virus and sent it in like everybody else does. Once in, the sample was reduced to code, and it activated and we were in their mainframe. Complete backdoor access to their data. I'm a second-tier buyer of their DNA. I buy it, isolate the DRD4 carriers we want, and match the serial number that comes on every sample to the flesh and blood bitch we then list on the site."
"That's genius."
"We think so."
"Who is we, by the way?"
Hammond hesitated, but only for a second. I have a partner. I'm DNA, and he's digital. He runs the site. I give him what he needs. We split the cash that comes in.
Sounds like a perfect partnership. What's his name?
He doesn't want to...
Roger Vogel, correct?
How do you know that name?
I know a lot because I've been here all night. Your records are not encrypted. Your computer security is a joke. Hammond did not answer. So, where can I find Roger Vogel to ask him for more details of your operation?
I don't know. He sort of comes and goes. He's a private guy, and we sort of lead separate lives. We were roommates once, in college. But since then, we don't see each other in person too much. In fact, I don't even know where the guy lives.
The Shrike nodded. Hammond's refusal to give up his partner was admirable, but hardly a problem. During the night, he had read numerous deleted emails still in the desktop's memory. Posing as Hammond, he had then sent a message to Vogel setting up a meeting for later in the day. Vogel had responded and agreed. It was now time to end this. He got up and started to walk toward Hammond. He saw his captive's arms tense and push against the bindings on his wrists. The Shrike held up a hand to calm him as he approached. "Just relax," he said. "Nothing to worry about. Not anymore." He walked behind Hammond, wondering how different this would be. He had never actually done this to a man. He quickly leaned down and wrapped his powerful arms around Hammond's head and neck, his left hand coming around and over his mouth so there would be no noise. Hammond's muffled cries of "No!" died in his hand, and soon there was the deeply fulfilling snap of bone, cartilage, and muscle twisting to the extreme limit. Hammond's last breath flowed hotly through his fingers.
Jack. Chapter 25. I got up early, but stayed in bed, watching Rachel sleep, not wanting to disturb her. I pulled my laptop off the bedside table and checked emails, finding the only one of note from Emily Atwater. It had been sent late the night before, asking me where the Deep Throat documents were that I had promised to send her after our call. She then suggested that I had intentionally held them back. I quickly wrote a return email apologizing for the delay and pulled up the documents to attach. I first gave each one a quick read so their contents would be fresh in my mind when Emily called later to discuss them. As I scanned the DNA report from the Orange County Sheriff's Lab, I saw a name I recognized. Holy shit! Rachel stirred and opened her eyes. I had jumped out of bed and gone to my backpack to retrieve the notebook I had used the night before while on the call with Emily. I came back to the bed with it and quickly opened it to the page where I had written down a name. It was a match. Marshall Hammond. "What is it, Jack?" Rachel asked. "It's Elvis in the box," I said. "What?" "Old newspaper phrase. It means the thing, the nuts, the photo everybody wants. Only this is not a photo. It's a name." "You're not making sense. Look at this." I turned the laptop screen so she could see it. "This is the DNA report from the Orange County Sheriff's Office that cleared Orton in the rape case down there. Remember Deep Throat sent it to me? Now look down here, where it says the name of the DNA tech who compared Orton's DNA to the sample taken off the victim." "Okay. M. Hammond. What does it mean?" "Marshall Hammond now works up here for LAPD's crime lab and lives in Glendale. My partner on the story ran the second-tier labs that have bought DNA from Orton's lab, and this guy, Hammond, is one of them. And get this, he buys only female DNA." "I'm not sure I'm following you. I need my coffee." "No, listen, this is big. This guy Hammond cleared Orton. Said the DNA was not a match. Now, 4 years later, he's in business with him. On the FTC paperwork, he says he's researching forensic applications of DNA, but he only buys female DNA from Orton." "Why only female if he's looking at forensic applications?" "You see, Emily and I
were already zeroed in on this guy, and now I found out he was Orton's ticket to freedom. That is no coincidence. I got up from the bed again and started getting dressed.
What are you going to do? Rachel asked.
I'm going to go to this house and his so-called lab and check it out, I said.
You shouldn't do that alone, Jack.
I won't. I'll call Emily.
No, take me. I want to go.
I looked at her.
I can help you get a read on this guy if he's there.
I knew that she could, but bringing her directly into the story would not go over well with Emily Atwater or Myron Levin.
Come on, Jack, Rachel said. We've done this before.
I nodded. Then get dressed, I said. Let's catch this guy before he goes to work. We can grab coffee after. Chapter 26. 40 minutes later, we were on the street Hammond had listed with the FTC as the location of his lab. It was a residential street, as Emily Atwater had determined on Google Maps. Let's do a drive-by first, I said. Get the lay of the land a little bit. We cruised by a nondescript two-story house with a two-car garage and a BMW SUV parked in the driveway. A little odd that the BMW is not in the garage, Rachel said.
At least it means somebody's probably home, I said.
Wait, Jack. I think the front door was open. Maybe he's about to leave. Turning around, I used a neighbor's driveway to make the maneuver and then drove back to Hammond's house. I pulled into the driveway behind the BMW. It was a reporter's trick. It would make it hard for Hammond to jump into his car and get away when I hit him with the hard questions. We got out, and I saw Rachel put her hand on the BMW's front hood as she passed by it. Still warm, she said. We approached the front door, which had been partially hidden from the street by a small front porch with leafy potted plants standing sentinel on either side of the entry portal. Rachel's observation was quickly confirmed. The door stood a foot open. The entry room beyond it was dark. On the frame of the door was a lighted button for a doorbell. I stepped up and pushed it, and a loud, solitary gong echoed through the house. We waited, but no one came. Rachel pulled a sleeve down over her hand and gently pushed the door open further. She then crossed behind me as she changed her angle of view into the house. There was a small entry area with a wall directly in front of us and arched entries to hallways to the left and right.
Hello? I called loudly. Mr. Hammond? Anybody home?
There's something wrong, Rachel whispered.
How do you know?
I feel it.
I rang the doorbell again, this time pushing it repeatedly, but only the solitary gong sounded. I looked back at Rachel.
What do we do? I asked.
We go in, Rachel said.
Something's wrong. The car engine's warm, the door's open. Nobody's answering.
Yeah, but we're not cops. We should call the cops.
I'm fine with that, if that's how you want to play it. But say goodbye to your story if the cops lock this place down.
I nodded. Good point. I stalled by yelling loudly into the house once more. No one answered. No one came.
Something's wrong, Rachel repeated. We need to check it out. Maybe somebody needs help.
This last part was said for my benefit, giving me the excuse I could use later if things went sideways once we entered.
Okay, I said. Lead the way.
She moved past me before I was finished speaking.
Put your hands in your pockets, she said.
What?
I asked. No prints.
Got it. I followed her into the hallway to the right. It led to a living room that was furnished in contemporary styles, with a Warhol print of a Volkswagen Beetle over a fireplace protected by a freestanding glass panel. There was a thick book called The Broad Collection on the table, between the maroon couch and two matching chairs. There was no sign of disturbance or anything wrong. It looked like a room that never got used.
Are we in the right house? Rachel asked.
Yeah, I checked the address, I said. Why?
The LAPD must pay its DNA techs a lot better than I thought.
Plus, buying DNA from Orange Nano can't be cheap. Next, we moved through a modern kitchen with an island counter that divided the space from a large TV room that looked out onto a pool. Nothing seemed amiss. Held by a magnet to the refrigerator was a color photo printed on cheap copy paper that depicted a naked woman with a ball gag in her mouth. Nice fridge art, I said. We need to check upstairs, Rachel said. We found the stairs by retracing our steps and going down the other hallway. Upstairs, there were three bedrooms, but only one that appeared to be in use. The bed was unmade, and there were dirty clothes in a pile next to it. A quick sweep of these rooms produced no people and no sign of trouble. We went back down the stairs. There were two closed doors at this end of the hallway. Rachel opened these with her sleeve-covered hand. The first was to a laundry room. Nothing there. The second was to the garage. And that's where we found Hammond's lab. And where we found Hammond, hanging from a noose fashioned from an orange industrial power cord. Shit, I said. Don't touch anything, Rachel said. Hands in pockets, I got that. Good. But I pulled one of my hands out of its pocket with my cell phone. I pulled up the keyboard and tapped in 911. What are you doing? Rachel asked. Calling it in, I said. No, not yet. What do you mean? We need to call the police. Just hold your horses for a minute. Let's see what we've got here. We've got a dead guy hanging from the crossbeam. I know. She offered nothing else as she moved in closer to the body. There was a wooden chair kicked over on its side below the body, which I assumed was that of Marshall Hammond. The body was suspended completely motionless in front of Rachel. Record this, she said. I moved from the phone app on my cell to the camera app and started a recording. Recording, I said. Go. She circled completely around the body once before speaking. I'm assuming the car out front is his, she said. So we are to assume that he went somewhere, came home, and then just came in here and threw that extension cord over the beam. The garage had an open ceiling, where there was some cross planking for storage up above. The center support beam had been used as Hammond's gallows. The body was suspended about 2 feet above the concrete floor of the garage lab. Rachel continued to slowly move around it, without touching it. No damage to the fingernails, she said. Why would there be? I asked. Second thoughts. Often people change their mind at the last second and claw at the noose. They break their fingernails. Got it. I think I knew that. But there is slight chafing on both wrists. I think he was bound, either at the time of death or shortly before. She looked around and saw a cardboard dispenser that held rubber gloves, most likely used by Hammond during DNA processing. She put on one glove and then used that hand to right the chair that had been knocked over during the hanging. She stepped up onto it so she could get a closer view of the noose and the dead man's neck. She studied it for a long moment before telling me to put on gloves from the dispenser. Why? Because I want you to steady the chair. Why? Just do it, Jack. I put my phone down on a table, then put on the gloves. I came back.